The young state of Maine comes into its own. When Maine became a state in 1820, a little less than 300,000 people lived here. By the start of the Civil War, that number had more than doubled. People came to Maine from other states and from places like Canada and Ireland to work in the lumber industry, cotton mills, shipbuilding factories, and other heritage industries, even in tourism. Maine was developing its distinctive culture, becoming the state it still is in many ways. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, as part of our year-long focus on Maine's bicentennial, we'll explore this period in Maine history, from 1820 through the Civil War. This period includes the growth of the railroads, the Aroostook War, and the Portland Rum Riot. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As part of our bicentennial coverage, we are doing a series of programs on Maine history. Last month, we explored the events leading to Maine statehood in 1820. Today, we will cover the period from 1820 through the Civil War era. It was a pivotal time here in Maine. Joining me in the studio, Liam Rorden. He is professor of history at the University of Maine, and Earl Shuttleworth, Maine State historian. And as always, we want to hear from you. Do you have family stories from this period in Maine history? Is there something you've always wondered about this era? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on today's Maine Calling Facebook post, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. It's always a pleasure to see you both and really looking forward to today's program. Liam, I'm going to start with you. Set the scene for us, Maine and the years right after statehood. What was Maine like? Where did the people live? Who were they?
So our starting point is 1820, right? Maine has separated from Massachusetts and become the 23rd U.S. state. And I think the most basic point to make is that there's just an incredible demographic engine of population growth. And so from, you know, we have a nice marker for this, the federal census every 10 years. And from 1820 to 1860, the population of the state of Maine is soaring. And that, I think, is indicative of a really booming economy and a lot of dynamic change, a lot of spread still coming out of sort of the southwestern and coastal corners of the state, moving up the river valleys, and particularly in that post-1820 period, new settlements of English speakers from the Kennebec River to the Penobscot, and still relatively less beyond that down east.
And Earl, the people who are part of this great demographic boom, population boom, where are they coming from to settle in Maine?
Well, at least in part, we have our first great influx of immigration. The Irish come first over to the Maritimes from Ireland in the 1820s and 30s. And they come down into Calais, and then from there they walk the old airline route to Bangor. Mm. Bangor in the 1820s and 30s is emerging as the major lumber port in America, actually, and has that distinction well into the 19th century. And so it's really a catalyst. People are attracted to it. And then when you have the great troubles in Ireland in the 1830s and 40s with the potato famine, then that drives many more Irish to come to our shores, and many of them come in through Portland. It really coincides with a great economic engine that is occurring in Maine in the period between 1820 and the Civil War. One of the issues, in addition to the lumbering, is the arrival of the Industrial Revolution, and particularly in the form of the textile industry in Saco, in Biddeford, in Lewiston, in Augusta. Massive brick mills are built, and in many cases they're built with Irish labor, and the Irish are a very important workforce in the development of this period.
Mm-hmm. And Liam, coastal Maine at this time is a very sophisticated place, isn't it?
It is. I think the older settlements on the coast, and you know, Portland would be our classic example, are places that are enjoying a lot of wealth in this period of prosperity and are booming. But I do think it's important to not only think about those sorts of high points of success and accomplishment, a lot of which are really the best preserved, you know, those houses of wealthy people, their personal papers, the kinds of objects that they collected. You know, that's a relatively easy story to embrace and understand. And so I think it's important, too, to recognize that there was a huge range of economic status in this state. And this really brings me to one of my favorite characters. I actually am going to be teaching about him tomorrow in my course on the Revolution. He's a fellow named Joseph Plum Martin, who served from start to finish in the Revolutionary War. And what is remarkable about him is that he published a memoir in Halliwell in 1830 that really lets us understand something about the sort of rank-and-file soldier and what his experience was in this post-war period. And in a lot of ways, that experience was to highlight the shortcomings of what our highest aspirations would have been for what the American Revolution would achieve. So he moves to Prospect as a founder of the town of Prospect, Maine, sort of modern-day Stockton Springs. He's the town clerk. He had some education. But he never is able to succeed financially, has some conflict with Henry Knox, the great proprietor of this region, and ends up applying for a pension for his war service that he gets. And in this era, you only got a pension if you could document your poverty. What's kind of neat is that he also is incredibly funny and had a great command of language. So this memoir is fascinating, and it gives us a richness and this sort of Yankee wit, but also set against this background of real economic privation and never being able to succeed.
Sure. And disappointment. We had the historian Alan Taylor on Maine Calling several months ago, and he talked about the people who came from the Revolution. Some of them wanted to preserve the culture as it was under the British, but others wanted a whole new way of life. And Maine was really a hotbed of this conflict, correct? Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Well, I think also what Liam has brought out is that during this period of 1820 to 1860, while we have highlighted some of the coastal maritime activity and we've talked about the Industrial Revolution and the lumbering, there are a great many people who continue with traditional occupations, with fishing, with farming, and with just shipbuilding, maritime trade. But in particular, agriculture is very important in this period. And what you find in this 1820 to 1860 period is a growth into the inland part of Maine like never before, with whole counties opening up with agricultural activity. Somerset County would be a good example in central Maine. And also, once you have the boundary dispute settled in 1842, then you have the opening of Aroostook County. And the decade of the 1850s is when people began to pour into Aroostook to develop it agriculturally.
Okay, so you mentioned the border dispute being settled in 1842. I understand that was called the Aroostook War.
Well, that was what preceded settlement of the boundary dispute.
Okay, give us a history lesson, Earl.
Well, late 1830s, the boundary is still not settled from the time of the Revolution. And one of the strong factors in developing what we call the Aroostook War of the late 1830s is that Bangor had become this great lumber boom capital, and many of the wealthiest men in Bangor were very concerned about where the border was in terms of where they could take their timberlands. You know, what would be the future of lumbering in Maine? And so there was really a kind of a challenge to what that border was, and to the point where the Maine legislature and the governor got behind sending up troops, Maine militia troops, to the border. President Buchanan heard about this. He was very concerned because this was a state really acting in a military fashion in relation to another country, Canada, which was then under British domain. General Winfield Scott was actually sent to Augusta to kind of help mediate the situation. And finally, you know, it calmed down, troops withdrawn, and it gave the impetus for the treaty to finally be settled in 1842. It's called the Webster-Ashburton Treaty. Daniel Webster was Secretary of State at the time, great political figure of the first half of the 19th century in America, and he and his counterpart, Lord Ashburton from England, finally settled on the border.
So in this period we're talking about, Maine's border is finally drawn.
That's right.
And also I understand that the capital moves from Portland to Augusta. Why does the capital move from Portland to Augusta?
Well, in 1820, when Maine became a state, of course, as we spoke of a little bit earlier in one of our earlier segments, the Constitutional Convention had taken place in Portland in 1819. Portland was the largest town in the state. It was the major port. So it was the logical place for people to congregate. And initially, the concept of state government was that it would operate in Portland, at least initially. But there were issues involving Portland that mitigated against its long-term being the capital. One of them was the fact that it was a vulnerable port. And if you looked back in Portland's history up to 1820, it had been destroyed three times already. And there was this concern, particularly with the fact that the War of 1812 had only been over for a few years. So that was issue one. Issue two was the concern that Portland was not the geo-population center of the state. At that time, it was more in the Hollowell-Augusta area, with Bangor sort of being the north. And so that was an issue as well. In 1822, the legislature creates a committee to look into different sites for the new capital, and it initially settles on Augusta. But it takes another 5 years of legislative debate before finally it's finalized in 1827 that Augusta becomes the capital.
You know, we've talked very briefly about the Industrial Revolution and the mills and the growth in the lumber industry and Bangor becoming the center of the lumbering industry in North America. Also shipbuilding, a huge industry in Maine. And what strikes me is, as I'm saying these things out loud, is how much this period of time defined kind of what we think of Maine today. I mean, we think of ourselves as being famous for shipbuilding, as having these vast forest lands. And although the mills, many of them are gone, we see this resurgence in Biddeford and Saco around the mills.
So I think that's absolutely right, and I think it does have a lot to do with this being the most prosperous era of Maine history. And it's going to turn relatively quickly after the Civil War, so it's really that stretch from 1810, 1820 through 1860 when things are booming. And one other sort of long continuity we might point out is that by the 1840s and 50s, we really have the start of rusticators and tourism to Maine. And Maine is also getting placed in the imagination that way. A lot of accounts, both literary and also visual, of Mount Katahdin come from this period. So you're right. There's a whole range of ways in way that this really sets a lasting model for how we think about the state.
And thinking about the lumber industry, and Earl, you very well may have written this. It is not authored, but from Maine Memory Net, the Maine Historical Society, I'm reading about the lumber industry, and you or someone wrote, in these flush decades, lumber production shaped Maine's politics in ways that sometimes hindered further economic growth. I thought that was fascinating, that something could be good and bad for the state at the same time.
Mm. Well, one of the issues, and it comes out very early on, is that when Maine becomes a state, it in a sense inherits or carries over from Massachusetts a large body of public lands in the north. And in his first message to the legislature in 1820, William King gives this caution. He says, "We must take great care to preserve our public lands." But as the 19th century went on and there was so much pressure among the commercial lumber industry, a lot of those public lands gravitated out of the public realm and ended up in the commercial realm. And I think that's maybe one of the issues that's related
yeah.
to that.
Yeah, of the issues is the ownership of the land. And also, I'm reading again here, in the long run, seasonal work in the woods and mills anchored people to lands that should not have been cultivated, perpetuating a cycle of low wages, indifferent farming, and rural poverty.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, as Liam has been saying and as you have said, this period is such a formative period. These 40 years of the first 40 years of statehood is when a lot of the trends and themes and practices get solidified.
I think, too, and again, this would be a long-term continuity in Maine history, this economic boom is really fueled by extractive natural resources. So agriculture, lumber, granite, lime, ice, the maritime trades, fishing, shipbuilding. And one of the challenges is that these are not necessarily capital intensive. They're labor intensive. And so there's not as much investment. You know, we do have a takeoff of manufacturing in Maine in this period. And it is a big change for Maine, but by national standards, it's not having the sort of lasting impact that it would in other places.
Well, and you also have with some of these resource-based industries, as you get into the 20th century, they phase out. Granite, for example, it was a major force in the 19th century to build buildings, but then comes steel frame and concrete construction and high-rise buildings and very little use for granite except for trim. The same thing with ice. The ice industry starts in this period in Maine, but then in the early 20th century comes electric refrigeration and, you know, ice peters out.
Yeah, and former Governor Angus King, Senator Angus King, used to point that out, that there is always change. That
exactly.
Ice used to be Maine's second largest industry,
that's right.
And that's not the case anymore. We are talking with historians Liam Reardon and Earl Shuttleworth. We'd love to hear your questions about the years of Maine's, I would say, early statehood, the years between 1820 and the Civil War. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu. Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com. And Modern Pest Services, offering a non-toxic approach to pest control with anti-CMEX smart pest control technology. ModernPest.com.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine.
We moved to Arundel, Maine 2 years ago from Boston when we were just ready for a change and to get out of the city. We love the community that's here. We love that we moved into our neighborhood and immediately were so welcomed by our neighbors. We're able to rely on all of these amazing people. Everybody here is so passionate and so hardworking and has a hustle and a side hustle and a passion project, and nobody talks about Maine and doesn't light up when they're talking about it. I'm Lisa from Arundel, and this is My Maine.
This Is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to mainepublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the history of Maine from statehood through the Civil War. My guests, Earl Shuttleworth, Maine state historian, and Liam Rorden, professor of history at the University of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I feel as though I'm just scratching at the surface. There's so many themes here, but I know one of the big themes of this time, Earl, is reform. And yes. We often think about the temperance movement, and that's one of the reforms that emerged from Maine famously during this period. But yeah. There are others as well.
Yes, indeed. This is the age of reform. The temperance movement, in many cases, people feel that it had a major impetus in its beginning in Portland, and its major figure was Neal Dow. Neal Dow actually became a worldwide figure through his travels and lecturing on behalf of temperance. He even ran for president on the Prohibition ticket at one point. He also was mayor of Portland during the 1850s, and it was at that point that there was a rather ignominious rum riot that ended in the death of a young man. So there was a lot of controversy about that. Temperance was one of the big reforms, but there were others as well. Dorothea Dix from Maine was very involved in the reform for mental health, and indeed Maine was a leader in mental health. By 1840, we had one of the first major state mental hospitals in Augusta. Other reforms included anti-slavery. And then there were sort of anti-reforms. There was the backlash against the Irish that was known as the Know-Nothing Movement in the 1850s that resulted in the burning of a church in Bath and in the maltreatment of Father John Baptist in Ellsworth.
Mm. What would you like to add to that, Liam?
So anti-slavery would, of course, be another of the major reform movements of this era, and Portland was really an important center for that in Maine, as was Hallowell, which published the first abolitionist newspaper in the state, The Advocate of Freedom, in 1838. And it does sort of bring us back to something we talked about in a previous show, the significance of a small but dynamic black community in Portland and the role that they played in this anti-slavery movement. So one of its ministers, Reverend Green, had himself been an escaped slave. And so this really brought the burning national issues of slavery and anti-slavery right to Maine in a very forceful way.
And what we find also is that this is a period, of course, it's enhanced transportation through steamships and railways, and many communities had what they called lyceums, the places where people went to hear speakers, and there were some of the great anti-slavery speakers of the pre-Civil War period came to Maine. William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass would be two examples.
I'm interested in, a Maine Calling show that was replayed earlier this week, in fact, with Keith Shortall hosting, talked about sort of Maine's until recently uncovered history in the involvement in the slave trade. And I'm wondering how much, if I were alive back in the 1830s in Hallowell, Maine, or Portland, Maine, would the people who were abolitionists, anti-slavery activists, I guess they didn't call them activists in the 1800s, would those people have been mainstream or would they have been considered fringe?
So I think this is a very important issue as we think back about this era and imagine what would it be like if we lived there. Everyone today, of course, would say, well, I would have been an abolitionist. Clearly, I would have opposed slavery. But this was a very radical issue. And it really challenged a fundamental pillar of the U.S. economy and of U.S. national culture. So the short answer is no. These were extremists who were extremely dedicated to a single issue. And for average apolitical people, you would be wary and be like, oh, my goodness, he's going to talk to me about slavery again. I don't want to talk about it. I just don't care.
Well, it was an economic issue along the coast in particular, with shipbuilding and with the maritime trade, because a lot of the trade involved the carrying of cotton to England, to the mills over there. And so there was definitely a pushback when the anti-slavery movement began, when the abolition movement began in Maine. There were those who didn't necessarily support it.
And we can really see how disruptive the reform movements are for mainstream party politics, anti-slavery in particular, but also issues like temperance were ones that parties were very cautious of and worried about. They were controversial and divided people. And, you know, it's really what we would call today the sort of single issue politics, where it's this one issue is all I care about. I really want this to be the one. And those are extremely difficult things for parties that are trying to build broad coalitions to deal with.
And politically, in 1854, you have this huge turning point where the abolitionist forces come together to help create the Republican Party. And in the very center of the formation of the Republican Party is one of the Washburn brothers from Maine, Israel Washburn Jr., who later becomes our first Civil War governor. The Republican Party is really the outgrowth of this new political concern.
And I'm going to go to the calls in just a minute. We have so many coming in, but we haven't even mentioned the Maine's involvement in the Civil War. And I think most people have heard of Joshua Chamberlain in the 20th Maine. But I want to broaden this out just a little bit, Earl. How many people from Maine served in the Civil War? What percentage of folks, say, in the Portland area versus some communities were more affected than others.
Yes. First, just the broad view.
Yeah.
Over 70,000 men enlisted in enlisted in over 30 regiments.
So more than 1 in 10 citizens in.
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Absolutely. And of those, between 10 and 11,000 did not come home. They were either lost on the battlefield or lost to disease. This certainly has an effect on Maine's growth, which Liam can get into in a moment. In terms of communities, Portland at that time had a population of about 30,000 people. Of those 30,000, in the course of the war, about 5,000 men, about a sixth of the population, enlisted in the war. You have little communities such as Sherman up in the northern part of Maine. There are in 1860 about 120 men between the ages of about 18 and 45 in Sherman. By the end of the war, about 110 out of those 120 have participated in the war. So Maine made a very significant contribution to the war. And it's very interesting. You know, I've studied a lot, particularly the Civil War monuments all around the state. There are about 175 of them. The inscriptions on them tell a very poignant story. Again and again and again, they say to preserve the Union. That was the central issue. Only a couple of them mention the issue of trying to abolish slavery. Foremost in the minds of those men who went was what Lincoln talks about, you know, the mystic chords of memory going back to the Revolution, the need to preserve what was achieved in the Revolution that was being threatened by the disunity of the country.
And you, Liam, had talked about this great boom time in Maine. Does the Civil War bring that boom to a screeching halt?
It does in a lot of ways, not exclusively the war itself, but that decade from 1860 to 1870 is the first time that we see an actual decline in Maine's overall population. And I think just as Earl mentioned, it wasn't necessarily high casualty rates, though that was part of it. It was also that a lot of young men served in the war, saw other parts of the country, and are beginning to think about moving west themselves. And I do think this has to do with a sense of the limitations of agriculture in Maine, the limitations of the economy. This is also, I think, part of the reason that there's such high rates of participation in the army is that, you know, they are motivated by ideals of the nation, but also by a lack of economic certainty about what to do at home. So we certainly see the population and the economy particularly takes a turn for the worse after the Civil War.
We'll go to Barbara, who's calling from Cranberry Isles. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you. I love programs about Maine history, and this is very interesting. But I also find it pretty shocking in this day and age that this story would be told largely through the lens of European immigrants with no mention of the people who were already here, namely indigenous people. And when you talk about those population swings, were Maine natives adequately counted, and were their populations diminishing during this period or any period of Maine history? And why isn't that more a part of our story?
Barbara, thank you very much. It's a terrific question. I want to add that we're doing a whole series of programs this year on Maine Calling, and definitely, absolutely plan to talk much more about the Wabanaki people of Maine. But to your immediate question about what was happening to the population of the Native American population in this period, Liam.
So that date of 1820, when Maine becomes a state, is a really important moment for Wabanaki history as well, in a negative sense, that this marks a intensification of colonization that they have experienced and suffered already for centuries, and the demographic growth of the state, which is overwhelmingly of people moving from southern New England into Maine, is directly challenging the Wabanaki homelands in the Penobscot River Valley and further down east. We do have some population statistics of people who were living in the traditional tribal lands that are served by Maine government agents in this period. And it's a time of dispossession and population loss, and yet another moment when Wabanaki people, to survive and persist, demonstrate an incredible combination of both commitment to traditional forms of work and culture and expression, and also are highly adaptive. So the most striking example of that might be the creation of traditional objects for sale, and the way in which that's modified in the 1840s to add fancy baskets as a kind of item that's of interest to these rusticators that are beginning to come to Maine in that period. So, you know, this is always this difficult balance of how do we forthrightly acknowledge the pain and dispossession, but it's important not to let that completely drown out a sense of Wabanaki resilience, and that, as we know from reading the papers this week, are still really important players in Maine politics, society, and culture.
Barbara, thank you so much for your question. We have an email from Elizabeth. Can you talk about the role of the railroad in Maine during this period? I learned through reading a history of Buckfield, Maine, which I have heard was a vibrant community because the railroad went through there.
Yes. In the period, well, of course, railroads come into Maine in the early to mid-1830s. And the earliest locomotives in some cases are actually ones that were made in England, where they were at the very same time instituting railroads. But by the time of the Civil War, there are about 400 miles of railroad in Maine, and railroads are becoming a major factor. For one thing, the creation of the Atlantic and St. Lawrence Railway between Portland and Montreal really gives Portland an economic boost that goes on for decades into the 20th century, the connection of the Port of Portland with the center of Canada. That's one very important factor. Many of the railroads start out as short lines, as very small local enterprises connecting only a few communities. But then by the mid-19th century, you have the consolidation of railroads, ultimately coming after the Civil War in the creation. Well, actually, I think the incorporation is during the Civil War, but it doesn't actually take place till after the Civil War, what's called the Maine Central Railroad. And yes, there are other railroads, but that becomes the dominant railroad. And it becomes a huge interconnecting force in Maine as the 19th and early 20th century emerge.
I don't want to be the purveyor of gloom all the time, but I think railroads bring a great opportunity and significant economic development. Certainly the opening up of Aroostook County for the export of food. But in that post-Civil War period, the growth of a national market and long-distance transportation through railroad systems is part of what's such a challenge to the Maine economy. When you can get meat from cattle and feedlots outside of Chicago cheaper than you can raise them in Maine, that's a real dilemma. So it's sort of a version of the sort of way we have ambivalent feelings about globalization today. You know, the larger these markets get, the more difficult it is to have sustainable local development.
We're going to take another quick break talking about Maine history in the period between 1820, statehood, and the Civil War. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On February 19, 1898, the majority of the dead, 135 bodies, were recovered from the wreckage of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor. Work on the wreck of the Maine stopped on April 3, 1898. All divers and tugs were withdrawn from the site, and the recovery of bodies was called off. U.S. naval authorities reported that 266 men died in the incident. In 1925, a memorial was built in Havana to the men of the Maine.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine!
Hello, I'm Philip Yun, host of World Affairs. The U.S. is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, yet 1 in 7 Americans lives below the poverty line, and countless others struggle with addiction and depression. Next on World Affairs, Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn speak with Mina Kim. They talk about the crisis in working-class America. Their new book is Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what was happening in Maine after statehood through the Civil War? My guests are Liam Reardon. I think I'm saying your name wrong.
Reardon.
Reardon. I apologize.
That's okay.
You, Maine professor of history, and Earl Shuttleworth, state historian. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Barry on Facebook says, my great-greats of Maine arrived in Maine during this era. This fleshes out the era for me. One was sent to Boston from England as a young child to apprentice in shipbuilding trades and then ended up in Camden's shipbuilding trade. One was given land in Solon for service in the Revolutionary War and farmed. Others left a life of fishing on Martha's Vineyard, as my grandmother liked to tell, because the women were tired of losing their men at sea, settling in the new vineyard area of western Maine, far from the sea. I'm so proud to have this heritage in my blood. Do Barry's ancestors really well represent the people of Maine in that era?
Oh, that's a textbook example. It's wonderful. Yeah.
We'll go to Sharon, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd just like to comment on a book. It's written by Brian F. Schwartz, a friend of mine who used to be an editor at the Bangor Daily News. He's now retired. And he's writing a series of books called Maine at War. And the first one he's written is called Volume 1, Blandensburg to Sharpsburg. It's the first 18 months of the war. He writes from diary. He's done a lot of research from diaries and books and letters home and very unusual stories about the farm boys and the mechanics and the loggers and all the people that went to war and whether they went to sea or the battlefield or whatever. And I just wanted to put a plug in for that. And then my second comment, when I was a little girl growing up in Dexter in the 60s, there was an elderly man across the street, Harry Young, and he had one of his school books from when he was a little boy. And it listed Bangor, Maine, as the logging capital of the world. So that probably would have been the 1880s or something like that. And I thought that was interesting. Thank you for your time. And also, your history series are wonderful. I'm enjoying them so much.
Oh, that's so great. Thank you so much, Sharon. Thoughts?
Yes, well, I would definitely say on the textbook that's a great comment, that it just affirms what we've been saying today. And as far as Brian Schwartz's work is concerned, I have read it, and I think that he's really one of our most gifted Civil War historians. He's done a lot of very good research and writing.
And it just reminds us of the incredible power of the Civil War in the historical imagination of American culture into the present, not only works like the kind that Brian is writing, but also Earl's mentioned that practically every town in Maine, you can find a monument to the Civil War. And this is part of the ways we keep that memory alive.
An email from Susan related to this. Leeds, Maine had the highest per capita ratio of people to serve in the Civil War. And abolition of slavery certainly was their cause. Major General Oliver Otis Howard, although terrible on indigenous rights, was a fervent abolitionist and founded HBCU Howard University, which his daughters attended.
That's correct.
Yes.
Howard, he's a great example of an abolitionist who then is a general and has all sorts of endeavors to try to improve the situation of people of African descent. And as your email mentioned, also has a terrible history of participating in anti-Indian wars in the plains in the post-Civil War period, sort of where the U.S. Army will deploy after the Civil War is over.
But Howard, the founder of Howard University, is from Leeds, Maine.
Absolutely, yes. And the Civil War monument in Leeds is this huge granite cenotaph, which is actually called a peace monument, interestingly.
Yeah. An email from Robert. I'm familiar with the role of the Homestead Act in granting lands in the American West. Was there something similar to encourage settlement of rural Maine?
There was.
Yeah.
The state took steps to try to develop down east and interior parts of Maine, actually offered better terms than the Homestead Act offered, but they were really up against the limits of the agricultural economy, just the environmental, ecological parameters of it. You know, there is a rich agricultural region in Arista County, but in other ways, when you get east of the Kennebec River, it's very challenging for agriculture. So a lot of that land was never sort of promoted and developed and sold in the ways that all sorts of large-scale landowners hoped it would.
We'll go to Doug, who's calling from York. Hi, Doug. Go ahead.
I was just curious about how immigration at that time, systems and procedures and laws and so forth, were a help or a hindrance, or was it a big social issue in regard to the influx of some of the population into Maine?
So, you know, one of the fascinating issues when we think about contemporary immigration issues is that throughout the 19th century, there is no federal bar or limitation upon immigration, right? There is a desire for more immigrants to help fuel the industrial manufacturing expansion in particular. And one interesting thing about Maine in this regard, I think Earl was right to note that you have waves of the Irish coming in the 1840s in particular, and French Canadians, particularly in the 1860s. And those are significant changes. But when you look at the overall portrait of the Maine population, I think in the 1850 census, 95% of Mainers had been born in the United States. Now, that partly might indicate the youth of the population. A lot of them are literally born in Maine. But it also, you know, in this period of expansion, you can have a lot of new numbers. But as a percentage of the overall population, it still is overwhelmingly native-born in the U.S.
Right. The other major population influx, of course, happens after the Civil War with people coming down from Canada to work in the mills and the shoe factories in the 1870s and 80s, the French-Canadian influx.
And we'll talk about that next time we have
you back, exactly.
Earl. So, Doug, thanks so much for your question. I'm looking at the clock and realizing there's some really important things that we haven't talked about. One is a person, Hannibal Hamlin.
Yeah. Well, Hannibal Hamlin is born on Paris Hill in Oxford County in 1809. He becomes a lawyer. He moves to the Bangor area, initially Hamden, and then later in life lives in Bangor. He becomes very politically active in the 1840s, serves in the Congress during the 1840s and 50s, gets elected governor in the late 1850s, is one of those men who switches from the old Whig Party into the Republican Party when it was founded in 1854. Then he has a very high profile nationally. And so in 1860, when the Republican Party nominates Abraham Lincoln of Illinois, which is then the West, for president, they need a balance, a geopolitical balance. And that balance is Hannibal Hamlin from Maine, who is very clearly a Republican and anti-slavery, anti-abolitionist. And so he becomes Lincoln's first vice president and serves from 1861 to 65. The determination by the party is made that they need a border state person when they run again with Lincoln in 64. So they bring in Governor Andrew Johnson from Tennessee, which is a rather fatal historical mistake, perhaps, because he doesn't turn out to be as strong a president, I think, as Hannibal Hamlin would have been if we lost Lincoln.
Another very important, probably the end of this period, would be one of Maine's great catastrophes, the Great Portland Fire.
Yes, the Portland Fire. You might call it an over-celebration of July 4th. It was a situation where it was the first July 4th celebration that everybody could participate in after the Civil War. Of course, the Civil War was over in April of 65, but it was July 66 where the city really went all out for its celebration. And in the late afternoon of July 4th, there are conflicting accounts, but whatever started it, the fire started in a little boat shop at the foot of High and Commercial Streets. Initially, it didn't seem to be very much, but then it moved on to a large adjacent industrial complex, J.B. Brown Sugar House. The sugar house, eight stories high, ignited. The wind was just right, going from west to east. The tide was out. There was no major central supply of water. When they had fires along the waterfront, the firemen would have to put their hoses into the bay, into the waterfront. And so as a result, all these factors came together, and between the late afternoon of July 4th and the morning of July 5th, the fire swept right through the very center of the city, destroyed about a third of the city, left 10,000 people homeless, a third of the population, caused $12 million worth of damage, and was the worst urban fire up to its time in American history.
Mm. So a period of Maine's history that started out so wonderfully ended really terribly. And you know, I just want to turn to you one more time, Liam, and ask, who have we left out? Who do you want to talk about that, you know, who's a pet historical figure from this time in Maine that we haven't talked about yet?
So, you know, one of my favorite characters from this era is a guy named Major Jack Downing. And he was a fictional character who was made by Seba Smith, first in a series of newspaper letters. And this is really an extraordinary moment of the creation of a new kind of political satire. Major Jack Downing speaks in Downeast dialect. He is sort of like the Stephen Colbert of his era. He's an Andrew Jackson enthusiast, but the author, Seba Smith, uses that to make fun of Jackson and show the limitations of that Jacksonian movement. And this was, you know, from the 1830s into the 1850s, this was a character who was known all around the U.S., this Major Jack Downing and his sort of comic commentaries on politics.
Were these commentaries published in newspapers across the country?
Yes, published in newspapers and then in the 1850s collected and published in book form.
All right. And Earl, what about you? One more person?
Oh, my. Good question. Let's see. Leon, throw me a person.
You don't have to. Instead, we can talk about the exhibit at Bowdoin.
Why don't we do that?
At Bowdoin College right now, two wonderful exhibits. We've already talked about Rufus Porter on Maine Calling, and there's a wonderful exhibit of Rufus Porter's everything from sketches to other historical artifacts about his time. But you curated the one right next door, Earl. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, again, we've been concentrating on the first four decades of statehood and into the Civil War as well, roughly 1820 to 1865, 1870. And the exhibit that you've mentioning that's currently at the Bowdoin Museum of Art is an exhibit that I curated on town and city views of Maine between 1830 and 1870. In that period, lithography came into New England. The first lithograph shop was in Boston in 1825. And artists began to create these beautiful panoramic views of towns and cities as they emerged. Portland, Bangor, Belfast, Rockland, Bath, and so on. All of these emerging centers of commercial and industrial activity. Biddeford-Saco was another one. And these communities really celebrated themselves and promoted themselves not only internally but also to the outside world by having artists do these beautiful scenes of them, and then turn them into lithographs.
And they're beautiful.
They're beautiful lithographs. They're beautiful works of art.
I saw them, and I have to wrap up, Earl, but I would highly recommend somebody stopping at the Bowdoin Museum of Art. And I have to say thank you to both of you, Earl Shuttleworth, Maine State historian, Liam Reardon, professor of history at the University of Maine. This is Maine Public Radio.